Time for this week's Sports Lit 101, and Bruce with us to talk more about this wonderful book on baseball that we discussed a little bit of last week.
Yeah, it's called Baseball, The Turbulent Mid-Century Years. It's by Stephen Gietscher. And I don't really even know how to completely put this book in context, but to give you an idea of what it meant to me, this morning I got up at oh dark 30 and read about 60 pages. I had about 130 pages to go. And or maybe a little less than that. Had to run an errand down to Brunswick and back. As soon as I got home, I ate lunch. I sat down in the lounge chair in on the porch and finished reading it and notating it. I don't know that I've ever underlined more stuff. This is the best baseball history book that focuses on a period of time that I've ever read. This takes us up, you know, through the careers of Mays and Mantle and Berra and people of that era, through the move of Major League Baseball to the West Coast, through early expansion, takes us through the Ford Frick, the Happy Chandler, the Kennesaw Mountain Landis era as commissioners, but does it in a way that it puts everything into a social, historical, cultural context. Not overwhelmingly so, but all of the major, shall we say, upheavals that had to do with people wanting to transfer cities, with minor league issues, with people like Branch Rickey bashing heads with people that had different kinds of ideas, to all the big people, all the big personalities in baseball, and all the owners and the owners' big personalities like Vec, or owners like Tom Yawkey, who were just stupid about you know, spending gazillions of dollars of money and never winning, right? To owners that were very shrewd and smart and found ways to win despite not having big budgets. But it really takes you through, and when it says the turbulent mid-century years, that's what they were. Mm. You've got the Great War, which disrupted baseball, and World War I made America go to a draft for the first time, made us reconsider what it meant to be a citizen soldier. Come out of that, get into the roaring 20s, things are looking up, and bang, they come crashing down with the Depression. The Depression in baseball, people don't realize there were times there were 300 minor leagues, not teams, right? And that will crash, and then baseball will have to rebuild during the Depression. Baseball's back up, it's running, things are going great. Boom, we get World War II, and once again, baseball and America have to decide whether baseball should continue or stop during the war. Now, Franklin Roosevelt green-lighted baseball and said, no, please don't stop playing. I think this is really important. It's going to come up again in Korea. You know, Ted Williams is going to go back into the service in Korea. There are ball players who could have been exempted because they were 4F that found ways to get into the service because they didn't want to be known as dishonorable, or they didn't want to be known as slackers. There were baseball players who were erroneously reported in the press to have tried to evade the draft but hadn't. And so you've got that going on. You have obviously the question hanging over baseball from the dead ball era on is the exclusion of non-white ball players. How certain Cuban players passed as white, or maybe not, maybe weren't, but how African Americans were systematically kept out, and how there were people that were early on in favor of integrating the major leagues, but didn't have the clout or couldn't get the votes. People who were likely virulent racists, Kennesaw Mountain Landis being one of them. You have the reserve clause issue, which comes up continually from 1922 until it's finally abolished. You have minor leagues making deal with major leagues. You have the Pacific Coast League threatening to declare itself a major league. Constant reclassifications. What is AAA? What is AA? What is A? Can you force salary caps? There was a time, people forget that the pitch clock existed once upon a time. You only had 20 seconds from the time you towed the rubber to throw a pitch. How rules come and rules go. How the All-Star Game, the players were in order to keep them from forming unions, well, we'll put all that into a pension fund. And then we'll play two All-Star Games so there can be more money in the pension fund. how baseball raised incredible sums of money during the war for the war effort. Millions of dollars of war bonds were sold. At the same time, owners were trying to hide players in the minors. You get the big personalities, the Connie Macks, the Branch Rickeys, the Ed Barrows, the people that Ban Johnson, people that led organizations that were able to convince Congress that baseball was not a monopoly. Mm. Even though everybody admitted it's a monopoly. Well, it's not really. You've got people jumping to the Mexican League and then being told they can't play for 5 years. The struggle, the interesting struggle over to put games on radio or to televise them, which we've touched upon in other books, the Colonel and the Hog and some of the other baseball books that Crack of the Bat. But the whole idea that baseball originally worried that TV would be its downfall. And right now, the thing that's keeping baseball alive are the TV contracts, because attendance has not kept pace as with in certain other sports. You see the ups and downs. You see the attempts to change rules to make it. I mean, people forget that in 1953, the height of the mound was not standard. It wasn't until Bob Feller sort of said, well, you know, maybe if it was the same in every ballpark, it would be better. Some were judged too high, some were judged too low. That the game what we see today, which has certainly been tampered with quite a bit in the last few years, with adding the pitch clock and the batter's clock and the phantom runner for extra innings and those kinds of things. And I'm not here to argue whether we should do that or not do that. I mean, that's for people beyond me to decide. But all these things always were going on. Could bats be made of laminate, or did they have to be made out of one piece of wood? There was a time when a baseball bat could not be a laminated product. It had to be carved from one piece of ash. Now we have maple bats and the like. But what's really fascinating is to watch the way, at a time when people couldn't see people on TV, how baseball players became bigger than life. You know, that people, early in his career, people in New York, if you wanted to see Babe Ruth play, you had to go to Yankee Stadium and see him play. Or in a World Series, you could go to Ebbets Field, or you could go to the Polo Grounds if they were there. The arrangements, the way that there were two teams in St. Louis, the Browns and the Cardinals, and it never should have been two. And the Browns were woeful forever. That Chicago probably couldn't really support two teams when it did. New York had three, suddenly it was down to one. The struggle to get the National League back in New York was only successful because of the Continental League, which you'd never heard of, which never got off the ground, which was threatening to start up in the cities that Major League Baseball wouldn't expand to. How expansion rather than absorption of another league became the way things would go. But what's astonishing throughout this, and this is a lesson for people today about what you think about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court kept telling baseball, yep, it's a monopoly. Yep, but we can't change that. Congress has to change that. The law needs to be changed because baseball has simply been exempted by the way the law is written. And they would constantly uphold the lower courts and everybody, the Supreme Court, this Supreme Court, this, the Supreme Court, this. When the reserve clause got to the Supreme Court, they kept saying, talk to Congress. You know, this is what you need to do. You should get Congress to change the law. We can't change the law. We can rule on whether the law is constitutional or not. The way it is written, it does not violate, currently does not violate the Constitution. So you get all the sort of, you learn a lot about Bill Veeck that, you know, maybe makes you think, yeah, he was a great showman. Maybe he wasn't the greatest guy in the world. There are all these kinds of things, but it's always done with precise detail, and it's never a tell-all. It's never a smear book in any way. It just really goes into people's lives. And the great thing is, as an archival consultant to the Sporting News, Steve has access to all the sporting news records of all time. So when he go when he goes when he makes a statement like, you know, concessions became an issue in this period, you'll suddenly get the list of what every concession deal with every major ballpark was, and the and who did this and who did that, and of the like, and it's really interesting, and he, how many times the commissioner was saying, you know, you fellas need to restrain yourselves. This is getting out of hand, and they'd all agree, and then Yawkey would go out and spend $1 million buying off the bone pile, and that would drive prices up, and the other owners are going, what are you nuts, you know, and you're not successful, you never win. And another thing that Geisher clears up for me, Yawkey never lived in Boston. He always lived in New York City. He would stay in Boston when he was there, but he wasn't there all the time. He liked to go down to South Carolina to his place down there. His official residence was always New York City.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I'd known he was born in Michigan, but he'd been educated in Tarrytown and lived in the posh life in New York with the uncle who adopted him. But I had no idea that he never owned a home or a full-time residence in the city of Boston.
Very interesting. More on the book next week, or what's next?
No, I think I was thinking about that, Rich, but I think the best thing is to let people, just encourage people to read this book, because if we go into any part of it, we're going to be going to just a little bit of it. And I don't want to misdirect people to thinking that's what it's about. But yeah, it's not out yet. It will be out soon from Nebraska. Baseball, the Turbulent Mid-Century Years by Stephen Geisher. Next week, a new topic.
Okay.
This is called Needs Work. It's by My Life with Antique Boats by my friend Boyd Mefford. Boyd was a very well-known sculptor and artist who eventually took up fixing vintage boats. And I know Boyd very well. We used to carpool our kids to Montessori school, and we've been friends for years. And he and Jack Elliott are friends ever since I introduced him. But these are a series of articles for different publications that he wrote. He's a really interesting guy. And so we'll talk about Boyd, and we'll talk about Boyd's boats, and we'll talk about boating. And you see him here on the cover working on a vintage Chris Craft. That's one of the things that he did. He worked on other kinds of boats. But his stories of finding boats and learning about them and judging boat shows and stuff are just great.
Excellent. Well, that's coming up next week here on Sports Lit 101.